This is Bob Burton, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 4th of April 2012. Bob Burton, Part 1.
Robert Wellesley Burton. Born on the 18th of June, hence the Wellesley, 1941.
Sorry, don't get the Wellesley bit.
Lord Wellington. His name was Arthur Wellesley. So, 18th of June, the Battle of Waterloo, won by the Duke of Wellington, who was Arthur Wellesley.
And where were you born?
Sherborne in Dorset. I was born evacuated, which usually you get to laugh, because there was a lot of high explosive falling in London. We were living in Twickenham, and so the family was moved down to Dorset for my birth.
And it sounds like your dad was something of a military historian then, was he?
Latterly. He was a zoologist, very interested. He was originally going to be a historian, but he watched some ants on the parapet of the trench somewhere near the Somme, became absolutely fascinated, decided to become a zoologist. And in his old age, he went back to his interest in history, partly local history of the village we lived in, but also he became much more forthcoming about his time in the army, in the Royal Garrison Artillery. And he's even written it up. He wrote a manuscript, well, several, because he kept on, it evolved. And my next job, when I finished my current ones for the South Georgia Government and South Georgia Heritage Trust, is to try and knock this into shape, into perhaps, desktop publishable form anyway. Mm-hmm. So history runs in the blood, and I too have gone back to being a historian.
So was he an acting zoologist? Or did he...
Yes, that one of his claims to fame down south is that he wrote the Discovery Investigations report on sponges. He was the sponge specialist at the Natural History Museum, and in those days there are probably only two sponge specialists in the world.
That's going to do you the same.
Yes, now there's lots of them. But he wrote up the sponges, all preserved ones. He never went down south. So it was studying preserved sponges. So he has this little tiny toehold in polar history. He also wrote up the sponges, actually, for the Scots expeditions as well, which I've got them out there in the library. And some of his colleagues were the old discovery biologists like Harrison Matthews and Francis Fraser, always known as Jimmy. And I met these men when I was a young man. And then when I took over the South Georgia Museum in the mid-90s, of course, they'd all just died when I could really have done what I'm doing now for you and really interviewed them and get the anecdotes and everything. Alas, as so often, it was too late.
Mm-hmm. But how did these chaps strike you as a teenager?
Probably not so much teenager, as early 20s, when I'd meet them at zoo society dinners and so on. They were just grand old men. I was rather in awe of them, always been in awe of authority, as it were, and they were so much my senior. I'd sit and listen to them, get some of the little anecdotes of their life and times and their working life, but not much more, I suppose. They were a bit too remote. I didn't really spend any time with them. One I did spend a bit of time was Sir Alastair Hardy, who was the senior biologist of the Discovery Investigations. And there is now a Sir Alastair Hardy Foundation for Oceanographic Sciences in Plymouth. And he invented the Hardy Plankton Recorder. It's now called the Continuous Plankton Recorder, a machine which was towed behind a ship and collected plankton against a fine silk filter, which was on a reel. So it was reeled up into a bath of formalin. At the end of the cruise, you took it out and you could lay it out, and the speed at which it was rolled up was proportional to the speed of the ship. So you could say, right, that strip of silk was collected at this position in the ocean. So you got these continuous records, and they're done all around the world ever since the 1920s. And they're now being done between Stanley and South Georgia. So I'm rewriting the tourist book, which is given to all visitors to South Georgia. And I've just looked at the computer. I've just got a nice cutaway picture of this continuous plankton recorder. But Hardy came to lecture to his old school, which was my school.
Which is where?
And Oundle, which was back in the 50s. I was probably the only boy present who was actually interested in the Hardy plankton wheel and Hardy continuous plankton recorder. And the next morning I showed him round the school. Well, he knew, you know, it had obviously changed since his time, so I escorted him round. So, you know, that was someone it was a pleasure to meet, was he was the grand old man of British oceanography, if not certainly Antarctic oceanography.
I'm not sure of my chronology. Was Kevin Walton a teacher at Oundle?
He was.
At that time?
He was our workshop master. His nickname was Wetter Walton. I think because his initials were EWKW, so it was alliterative. I had little to do with him. You'd see him walking around with a Fidz anorak with the furry hood and a husky on a lead. So it was known that he'd been to the Antarctic, and he did give us a lecture, which was a great lecture with slides. And the one bit I remembered, his hit-and-miss navigation, which wasn't quite hit-and-miss, because where the huskies pee solidifies and the snow gets swept away, so you get a yellow column. Where they poo, the sun warms it up and it sinks into a hole. So that's your hit and miss, and you follow this trail back to get back to base. That's all I remember of it. And, of course, I later met him many years later when he was active with the Bass Club and I was active. He used to come to reunions. And, of course, his son is an ex-fid as well.
His daughter-in-law is my GP.
Oh, really? Gosh. Yeah. 'Tis a small world, isn't it? Mm. Yes. So I went to the memorial that was held at the Scott Polar, and, of course, my zoology master was there. He was a good friend, I think, of Kevin's. Yeah, so I suppose that was my introduction to the Antarctic. Yes, because people say, you know, how did you sort of get down there? And when I applied for the job, I say the only thing I knew about the Antarctic was that Scott had died in it. I really had no idea what I was letting myself in for.
Was there anything that kind of tied these grand old men of the Antarctic together? Was there a common fact you could spot, you having met a few of them over the years?
No, I don't think. I don't think I could say that at all. I didn't see enough of them or for enough time. Though, as to younger ones, when the Bass biological unit was at Monk's Wood up the road, the other side of Huntingdon, they were stationed at this, Nature Conservancy research station. And I had a friend who works on bats who worked there. He said that he noticed that the Bass people were of a type. And we sort of discussed whether it was people of that type who joined Bass or whether they developed into that type from the experience. And, we decided it was a bit of both. You've obviously got to be of a certain type to want to go and spend 2 years down in the Antarctic.
Well, you must be of that type then, mustn't you?
Yes. I was reading zoology at Cambridge, and not reading it at all well, and had no idea what I was going to do, except I had an idea that it'd be nice to travel somewhere, which people didn't in those days, back in the early 60s. And at the end of the year, notices went up on the departmental board with grants available, jobs available, and so on. And I sort of thumbed through this and saw British Antarctic Survey wants biologist. I thought, well, that's abroad. And the advert had been put there by Martin Holgate, who had just taken on the job as senior biologist and with the mandate of transferring Cygni Island, which he had visited a year or so previously, into a major biological station rather than as previously it'd really been a Met station with a few odd biologists. And I had, in fact, met Martin in my very first week at Cambridge at a party and got talking, and mainly because he'd been at Oundle for a short time. It wasn't academically good enough for his parents, so he was taken somewhere else. But he said he was working at the Scott Polar, where they had this nude statue, which was supposed to have been by Kathleen Scott, with Peter Scott as the model. And I said, oh, we've got one at school. And he said, oh, you must be at Oundle. So we had this, you know, young naked lad with an arm up saying, here am I, send me. And you could put dustbin lids on the upturned hand and put clothes on it and so on. And so I went round to the Scott Polar and said, don't you, if you remember me? And he said, oh, yes. I said, well, I've come to see about this job. And he showed me what was being planned for building the plastic palace, as we later called it. And I went for an interview, and I didn't get the job. I didn't perform at all well. Number one thing, Bill Sloman, who with Martin was doing the interviews, he said, you realise that not everyone will be university types, there'll be sort of mechanics and so on. I said, they're rather lofty. Well, I usually drink in the public bar. Oh, mate, you know, was this a good answer? Honest, but maybe not tactful. So I didn't get the job. That went to Tony Walker, who did marine biology, had a limpet project. But they said, go down as a meteorologist, met man, met observer, and you'll have plenty of time to do some scientific work. So that's what I decided to do. I mean, this is what a lot of people did then. If you wanted to go south either as an ologist or a surveyor, whatever, and you didn't get the job, or if you wanted to go just down for the hell of it, you signed up as a Met man. Every base had three or four Met men. Professional Met men were very rare. They were all people like me, going down for the fun, really. And in fact, it meant that Bass got all these people doing two jobs for the price of one. In fact, for the price of the cheapest. If I'd been a zoologist, they'd have paid me £550 a year. As it was, they paid me, as a technician, £500 a year, even though I was doing these two jobs. But really, that didn't figure. Compared with my really brilliant colleagues at Cambridge who got their grants to do PhDs, they'd be getting, what, £350, £400 a year to live in a university city. I was getting £500, all found, clothing, cigarettes, fair bit of drink, plus a salary. It was marvellous. Came back with money, bought a car, no problem. So we went off to the Met School at Stanmore, at this special Bass Met course, and the instructor, he said, you know, it's great fun having you chaps, because most of the people were, you know, boys with blazers, with rows of pens along the top pocket, going to become professional Met men. We weren't really terribly interested in the Met, and probably a little bit older. But he said, you know, we don't mind, you know, it's nice to have you along, but thank heavens it's only once a year. And after the first session, when we'd introduced ourselves and so on, and introduced from the instructors, we filed out, and I fell alongside one chap. His name was Barry Goodman, and it turned out that we were both going to Sydney. We were both sharing digs. In fact, we shared a bedroom, and we both felt the need for a beer, so off we went. And Barry was a lifelong friend until he died so 3 or 4 years ago. I suppose there's two or three from that class who I've kept in touch with. Some, alas, are now dying. I think it was 6 weeks where we learnt about Met, and our instructor said, we have laws of meteorology, but the weather doesn't know them. And this was a time, it was pre-satellites. We only knew what was coming our way from these weather ships in the Atlantic and the odd transatlantic flight. And it turns out, actually, that the weather was right and it was the laws that were wrong. Because I've just been rewriting a piece on climate and weather for the this government booklet, and I went to see a man in Bass, Phil Anderson, who's been researching weather down there, and I found it very difficult. First of all, he wanted to explain it in physical terms, which, of course, I'd be lost, so he had to use analogies. And even so, it just didn't fit together. And then I realised that what I had been taught at the Bass Met School was wrong.
In what way?
Well, I gather this didn't actually come up in the conversation, that what we were taught about frontal systems is wrong. But this particular thing, the dominating weather feature at South Georgia is wind. Mm. And at South Georgia and at Sydney Island, you get the fern wind, which you see by this cloud which fits closely to the top of mountains, and you get these warm blasts of air down the other side. And we were taught that as the air comes up over the mountains, it loses its moisture through precipitation. As it gets up to the top, the remaining precipitation condenses out as cloud, and then as it goes down the other side, it warms up and the cloud evaporates, so you get this line where the cloud ends. And because it's drier, it warms up more quickly than it cooled down, so you end up with quite appreciably hot air the other side. I get emails from South Georgia saying they're all looking forward to skiing, the snow is building up nicely. Fern wind comes around and it melts in front of their eyes. But this is not how it actually works. I still don't fully understand it, but it is due to the air just piling up over the top of the mountains, and then for some reason which I can't explain, it hugs the lee side down and warms up as it comes down. I don't know if you're any the wiser from that.
Well, but I suppose the question I was going to ask you next was, when you came to the end of your 6 weeks at Stanmore, did you feel you were a fully qualified Met man, or did you just have enough information and knowledge to get back?
I did quite well in the written paper on the theory. I wasn't so good at the practical. We had to do these pilot balloon ascents, where you track a balloon, you fill it up with a weight on the bottom, take the weight off, and then in theory it ascends at 500 feet per minute, and you track it with a theodolite, and then you work out with a slide rule about sort of 2.5 feet long. And I never really got the hang of that. I'm not good at maths, alas. It's been a great bugbear of my life, and thank heavens in those days zoology didn't need much mathematics. I think the other thing that I didn't feel qualified about was that we were being taught really Northern Hemisphere meteorology, and we're going to be down south where the winds go the other way round, the Coriolis force. As a result, I'm never quite sure which way they go round in any hemisphere, but I think we are lacking, and this showed very clearly when we practised, although after the course we were packed off to civil places like Birmingham Airport, Heathrow and so on, to go and practise in a Met office. The main thing was taking the various records, temperatures and all the rest of it, and turning them into this international code of five-digit groups. And I think a lot of us had difficulty with that, trying to work out how to do this. It's all a bit distant memory now, but things like clouds and cloud heights, some of those basic things like temperatures and dew points was easy, and wind speeds, but assessing the cloud status and so on, we used to fall foul of. And certainly when I started Met at Sydney, we'd send off the weather data, was it 3 times a day, and then we'd get a message back pointing out all the obvious howlers in this, which got better over the time. So in that way, no, perhaps could have been better prepared, but that may have been more me than the system.
So the guys, the Met men who went to Sydney that year, the three of you.
Yes.
In retrospect, looking back now, were you sufficiently qualified to do the job properly? Or wasn't it really quite up to scratch?
I think we were, yes. I suppose the only way you could learn to do this is through practice. Mm. And we didn't have enough practice for... Well, it's difficult to practice on Antarctic weather until you get to the Antarctic, I suppose.
I'm thinking that a lot of the more recent climatological research work and conclusions that have been drawn are based on 50 years of Met observations. Mm. Do you feel that the Met observations... And I appreciate Sydney was a rather special case, but do you feel that Met observations of that era are actually... sufficiently correct to base that science on?
I would have thought so, because the sort of things they'd be looking at for that would be the instrument readings, I imagine, which were straightforward. And also, we not only had to code up and send off, we had the stats, which was a big book, which we had to write in fountain pen. Mm. And if we made a mistake, we had to scratch it out with a razor blade, short supply these days, and ink it back in again. And they would have been done to a higher standard, and they were the books which would have gone off to the climatologists, I imagine. So I'd have said yes. Though we used to, I say download, a word hadn't been invented then, but we'd get the forecast sent out by the Stanley office, which we could plot out on a map. And we'd see a front coming in, and the next day it would have disappeared. I wonder where that went. And how they managed to forecast the weather, you know, the movements of these storms coming through, the depressions and the frontal systems, on such few data, just a few Bass stations and some ships wandering around, I don't know. It all seemed a bit... a bit magic.
Did the immature nature of weather forecasting at that time ever have any severe consequences? Did anything go wrong because...
No, because I don't think anyone ever used it.
You didn't trust it?
Well, we didn't really need it because, certainly at Sydney, we didn't need it for planning anything. I presume that the aircraft people must have used forecasts, but I wouldn't know anything about that. Oh.
What about the zoology? Because you said you wanted to do zoology work down there and you were given enough time to do so. Did you have to agree a programme before you left?
Not really. I told them what my programme was, I think. I had very little time to actually plan anything. Because I was kept... I suppose if I'd been a more forceful character, I would have said, well, instead of going and sitting at Birmingham Airport, getting very bored... I ought to be going off and seeing some zoologists who could instruct me in what to do. I did have one interview with someone who became a top zoologist in Cambridge, but he was terribly theoretical. What I wanted to know was actually what to do in the field. Mm. Luckily, I met someone at Queen Mary College, which was where the Bass biologists were based, and I went there and met this man who was doing some bird behaviour work, and he said, oh, have you seen this paper? And it was a paper on skuas in the Southern Hemisphere, on their behaviour, and that became my Bible. I was sort of partly repeating what this chap had done at Sydney, and there were one or two other things I sort of dreamed up from what I knew, but it was really sort of suck it and see. To some extent, this was, I turned this into a good thing. It actually made me think, rather than go down and just do what I was told. I actually had to think what was interesting. I had to look at these birds and say, well, I wonder why they're doing that. How can I find out? Which is the essence of science. And someone who came down the next year, Ron Lewis Smith, a botanist who spent all his working life with bass, he came down with his supervisor. And to some extent, we were jealous that he had this chap who he could say, you know, what do I do now, and so on, and could advise him. But there was this point, well, he he's missing this opportunity, perhaps, for sort of being very original. In fact, eventually, I think Ron was very original, but he did have this kickstart. And I think we did feel aggrieved that us three Met Men were launched without really knowing what we were doing. And we wrote to Martin Holgate, who was our supervisor, and got very little response because he was not just running for the Bass biology. I think he's already going onwards and upwards and disappearing into the corridors of power. So we didn't get much attention. And at the end of our first winter, he sent a sheet of A4 to the base leader with Bob, Mike, Barry, and the instructions to cut it out and give these little paragraphs to us. And that was our year's supervision. And Mike Northover, who was doing soil chemistry, he'd written saying, "What precisely am I supposed to be doing?" And the answer was, "I think your project is good." So, yeah, a bit of foundering. And it was only really into my last summer that Martin put me in touch with someone at Oxford University who was doing the sort of things that I'd be interested in. And I got a letter very late, so have you looked at this, this and this? And I had to rush out. The last breeding season was halfway through and I was running around checking things out, and which was very useful. So I did this field work, and my aggressive behaviour studies split up because I was looking at the displays these birds did when they were communicating with each other and trying to work out what the displays meant. I was also looking at aggressive behaviour as Martin of Frobbery first meant it, because if you walk up to a skua's nest, you get hit on the head many times. So at selected nests, I had a line of posts at 10-metre intervals. Actually, they were 10 paces, and I called them 10 yards, and the editor of the journal said, "We're metric," so I turned it into metre or something. It was just relative anyway, so it didn't matter. And I'd note how far I was from the nest when they started giving alarm calls and when they started attacking. So I actually got a change over the breeding season. I use this as an indicator of their desire to protect their nest, and that worked quite well. So that was two parts of it. But also, when I got to Sydney, I found that most of the breeding population had been colour-ringed for the previous 5 years. So I had a known population, and not only had these adults been ringed, their nests had been marked, little markers with numbers on them, and these had been mapped each year, and their chicks had been ringed. And once a chick gets to the age at which you can ring it, it's pretty certain it's going to grow up and leave the territory. So I had this really very good data on breeding success and breeding habits. And with my 3 summers, that gave me 8 years of breeding data, which at that time was a very good run. And it's rather disappointing that I come across learned books of ornithology which quote my breeding paper, but not my aggressive behaviour paper. No, that just disappeared, and no one took any notice of it. But the breeding stuff was going in quite useful, it seems.
How do you ring a skua chick? Because presumably the parents are still defending it.
Yes. Well, you have a ski stick which you hold up. I tried to. The trouble is they sometimes come in low. We had an old World War II helmet as part of the firefighting gear. So Tony Walker filmed me walking around with this helmet on, and skewers going boying off it. And we were issued with whalers' padded hats, a bit like these Russian hats that people wear, with, and you can pull it down so it protects your neck. But even then they could get in under and get you on the neck. And one hit me in the neck and I had to sit down. So you've got a 3 or 4 pound bird, and all this MV squared over 2 is concentrated on a thin wing feather, and it whacked me in the back of the neck and I had to sit down. And for about 5 minutes and recover. Another one got the wingtip across my ear, and that was really painful. So I never really got around that problem. There's one occasion I stood over a nest, and I think I counted how often I was hit. They were particularly aggressive. I think it was at 100 times in 5 minutes or something. I was very annoyed by the end of it, but it was all for science. Then as well as the skewer work, when I got the signal, they said, oh, if you're doing skewers, you can do the bird ringing.
Yeah, the bird ringing or seal tagging?
Both.
Both.
Yes.
Let me just ask you a bit more about the skewers, if I may.
Yes.
I mean, what was it that attracted you to the idea of studying skewers in the first place?
Just that it was bird behaviour, and I was interested in behaviour. And birds are the best animals to study behaviour on. Mammals are too secretive. So, really, that was all. It was a suggestion of Martin that this was a good project. So I said, OK, I'll come and do it. And as I read about it, yes, it did seem to be interesting.
And were the skewers that wised up about human beings? By the time
no, this was something I tried to look into, because you read the Heroic Age books and papers, when they got to places like McMurdo Sound, where people had never landed, they were attacked by skewers. So, I mean, how did the skewers know that they were to be attacked? And our skewers, they were very well of people, and they were still attacking, much more so than in Shetland. It was when I came back, I went up to Fula, where there's a big skewer population.
In the Scottish
Shetlands? Yes, yeah. Yes, up in the northern Shetlands. And this was one of the things I was looking up there to see if I could find out what elicited these attacks. Because someone at Oxford, based at Oxford, had looked at the anti-predator strategies of black-headed gulls. And using a stuffed fox, hedgehog, stoat, and so on, he put these out in the colonies and watched what the reaction was. And so I went up to the Fula with the same fox, hedgehog, stoat, a papier-mâché penguin, and what else did I do? Oh, a wooden box as a control to see what the skewers did. And it was roughly as you'd expected. What the chap at Oxford found was that something which attacked adults, preyed on adults only, like a falcon, the birds would run away from. Something which attacked only eggs and chicks, they'd attack strongly, like a hedgehog or a stoat. Something which was a predator of both the nest and the adults, like a fox, they were a bit ambivalent. They'd attack and then shear away, which is the swoop and soar attack, which is typical of skuas attacking us. So I thought, well, maybe it's they're looking on us as this predator of both them and their nests. But why? I don't know, because there's not much reinforcement for this. Is it the shape of the body, the upright body, hence the papier-mâché penguin, which sometimes got attacked quite strongly? They knocked its head off. And I had seen down south penguins actually drive a skewer off its nest. So perhaps they did see penguins as a bit of a threat. But I never wrote this up because I was never really convinced of any line of argument.
What other birds were you looking at?
At Cygni, I was bird ringing, and again, that they had been ringed a lot over the years, and a lot had been colour ringed. There was a colony of Cape pigeons, as we called them then, Cape petrels, where a chap called Ron Pinder, and he was a radio operator. He had studied them, and I'd go and ring all the chicks and as many as the adults as I could get hold of. Similarly, snow petrels, they were nesting behind the base. Also, Wilson storm petrels and prions, which are in burrows behind the base. And when I was on night met duty, I could go out and I had a little hook on a wire and pull them out of the nests and ring them. Giant petrels we did, particularly the nestlings. That was about 1,200 a year. And I don't know if you know that they object to being handled and they vomit up their last meal over you. And I went one back to base once and wandered into the kitchen for a cup of tea and got thrown out. I had to take my clothes off outside and come back in again. That was interesting because we got a lot of recoveries every year. If I remember rightly, it was something like 30 of these 1,200 would be found going around the world. So they'd be picked up dead on beaches around Australia, New Zealand, South America, South Africa and so on, and eventually come back to breed. Shags we did. We didn't do the gulls or the terns, which were a bit difficult to catch. Sheathbills, someone had studied sheathbills, a lot of colouring sheathbills. We had, first winter, a Norwegian ship came down with the idea of hunting crab-eater seals with their pelts, and they got stuck in the ice just north of Cygni. And so we had 24-hour radio watch in case something untoward happened to them. And I chatted to their biologist on board, and he said how they had these skewers with colourings on, which he'd shot. Those are our study birds. He was duly contrite. It was interesting that they were out there in the pack ice, actually.
Colouring them is rather like dyeing a sheep, is it, in a field?
Yes. We used, you know, spiral rings. We used to see them on chickens.
Right.
It's the same sort of thing. Latterly, I think they use actually plastic strips, which you bend round and then glue in place. They last a lot better as these plastic spirals.
On the leg?
Yes, yeah. It used to unwind, which was a bit unfortunate.
So they're kind of a ringing process?
But oh, yes, it is ringing.
A more
yes.
elaborate ring. Not.
You'd have colour combinations, so that you knew you could see a bird and you could see it was red over white over blue or something, and so on. That belongs there, and that's the mate of so-and-so.
Were there any big surprises in the work you were doing with birds?
Not really, no. No, I can't think of anything particularly surprising. There were one or two little bits of behaviour, I suppose, in which pairs of birds crossed over.
Got wife-swapped?
Yes. And they were colouring birds, so you knew they'd done it. And I think that was, if a male came back and said, you know, he took his territory again, normally his previous wife would come in and they'd settle down, because they are generally faithful from year to year. But sometimes a male would come in, and if his mate was late, he'd start courting another female, and the real wife would come in and shoo the other one off. And I think occasionally you could see where perhaps one female and one male had disappeared, so the two survivors would mate up. And I think what had happened is crossover was that it was sort of two latecomers and they remated and the other two had to mate. Something I imagine it was something like that. And occasionally there'd be a male, or presumed male, I think it was a male, would have two females, a bit of polygyny. There was one bird which did this regularly. It even changed mates. And each year it'd have two mates. And they'd lay four eggs between them, which is why I know there must have been two females and a male. But they never hatched out, because sometimes you get two birds trying to sit on the nest at once, or even if there was just one bird, there wasn't space for four eggs to fit under, so they'd get chilled and so not hatch. That was, it's amazing, actually, if you're doing research, if you find something out, even if it's something that everyone else knows, if you find it out for yourself, it's exciting. Mm. Even just working out the sort of incubation lengths. It's in all the books, the fact that I worked it out by watching eggs being laid and watching them hatching, it was a little feather in my hat.
Tell me about the seal tagging at Cygni.
Well, that again, I got down to Cygni and I said, oh, well, why, if you're going to do bird ringing, you might as well do seal tagging, which was a great sport. This was Weddell seals, a few elephant seals. The population had dropped very much since Dick Laws had done his study there. And we used cattle ear tags, putting them in the web of the hind flipper. And there'd be about 300 Weddell seals pupping around Cygni. And I'd go out with a companion and tag the pups, and those nearest the base in Borger Bay, I'd also tag the cows. And they were pretty relaxed about it. I remember once I tagged the pup, tagged its mother and walked round taking photographs, and she took no notice at all. Sometimes they did get upset and they'd redirect their aggression on the pup, which didn't do any good. So if that happened, I'd just shout, go, and we'd just run away and let them settle down. But a nice sport. And also I had a ski-doo to take me around, which was the first ski-doo in the Antarctic. There'd been other little motor vehicles. This was the first one sent down. It was supposed to go to Stonington Island, but they took it ashore at Hope Bay and ruined the drive belt. It had a sort of variable pulley system for changing gear. Very much like the motor mower I've got out there. And so they thought, well, Signy is going to have a last call from a ship, so maybe the spares will have been found by then. Later turned out, actually, they're on the same ship as the Ski-Doo, but they couldn't found them. And I was on board, coming back from a toothache trip, which more later, and Johnny Green, who was a logistics officer, was explaining about this, and they decided to put the Ski-Doo at Signy in the hope that the spares would get to it. And I said, oh, that's just what I need for seal tagging, buzzing around on the sea ice. And he said, oh, you know, could you look after it? I said, yes. He said, do you know anything about motors? I said, yes, I've got an old 1932 Morris Minor, which I sort of take apart and put together. So established my credentials. So there I was in charge of not only a Ski-Doo, they also gave us an Eliason, which was should have gone farther south and didn't make it. And that was an appalling machine. But the Ski-Doo was great fun. And so I'd spin round, stop at each group of seals and jump off. And tag them and jump on and off again. And then I used it for going around the skuas. At the beginning of the breeding season, there'd be enough snow to go out on a Ski-Doo, at least to my study area. But initially, I could actually drive past them through the territory, seeing who was there without getting off. But as they laid, of course, that was a bit naughty, actually driving up to the nest, so I'd stop and go and have a look. And it meant that I could get round my nests even when I was on Met duty, with Met odds 3 hours apart. I could rush over to the Gurley Peninsula, to my study area, and quit round the nests and rush back again.
Did you ever lose it, the machine?
Yes, I didn't. It was the second year. We just got the thing out, and I was out walking on the ice, and the Ski-Doo came past. We used to tow a Nansen sledge behind it for passengers. And they drove up, and Wally Dawson, the mechanic, was driving, and there were, I think, four others, Mike Northover, Mick Purbrick, Mick the Brick, Carpenter, Inigo Everson, and that may be it, can't remember now. And they stopped by me and said, there's some penguins out on the ice, do you want to come out? And I said, being a coward, I said no, because I could see there was a line of weak ice where it had broken out and reformed. We saw it go out and suddenly lurch, and this huge wall of spray went up. Spray came down and there's nothing there. And heads started popping up. And oh, God. And I was out there with Paul Pilkington, the radio op, and we rushed over very slowly because they'd given us some quilted parkas and trousers to trial. So we staggering out with these, and these people came rushing up to us and absolutely frozen and grabbing our dry gloves. And Inigo had hurt his ankle skiing the day before and he was sort of limping along, so I was escorting him back, and we got them all back indoors and virtually cut their clothes off them because they'd all iced up and sort of poured rum between their clenched teeth and so on. And what had happened, it was a very good thing that it went straight off the edge of the hard ice, which meant that when they came up, they could get onto something firm. Except Mick the Brick, Mike Northover got out first. He was standing on the back of the sledge with the handlebars, and he was able to leap pretty well clear and land dry. But he saw Mick Purbrick floundering in the wrong direction. He said, "Mick, this way, I can't swim." So Mike had to go in and get him out. So they were the two coldest. And Wally Dawson, he said he was wearing his camera under his anorak, which he did to sort of keep it warm, and trying to get out, it was getting caught on the ice. And he said he could feel his legs getting slower. And he was a big bloke, he was a very fat chap. And I think he had to have a little helping hand to get him out. So we were lucky in that respect that, you know, if he'd had foundered farther out, the chances of getting back would have been, I think, rather small. But then the next day the weather stayed fine, and we went out looking over the edge. You could see 30 foot down the skidoo with the sledge floating above it. So we cut a dock back into the firm ice, put shear legs over it and lowered a grapnel onto the sledge, and all pulled, and that came out. Sledge came out and transferred the grapnel to the skidoo, got that out and sledged it back. Then Wally and I stripped it down, dried it all out, got the salt out, started it up, and it had immediately stopped again. We realised the one thing we hadn't dried out was the coil. So we started unwinding this coil, which must be many miles of very fine wire, which kept on snapping. And then we recalled that we had a diving compressor which had broken down, and we had a look, and it had the identical coil. The Ski-Doo is made in Canada, but I've forgotten the make of the engine. I think it could have been a German two-stroke engine with this Austrian coil. And it was the same for the compressor. So we swapped them over and off we went again. So that was the saga of the lost Ski-Doo. I've often wondered, actually, times we came across a lead and I just say, right, I'll go for it and see if I can get across. And I always did.
And this was the first Ski-Doo or Ski-Doo in use in the Antarctic?
Yes. They previously had these Eliassons, these American things, yes. Which weren't too satisfactory, I gather. And they'd sent one to Kingston Tech to reduce its weight so it could be got into a plane. And they'd done it, but it was all welded up, and it was actually dire trying to get at any of the bits and so on. One thing they did, the idea was to drive it from a sledge so that if it went down a crevasse, you could jump clear, which meant that your throttle was on a string, so you'd start it up, and as the sledge came past, you'd jump on and off you'd go, steering with reins. And we did this on the Ski-Doo. But on the Eliasson, the throttle lever was on top of the cylinder. And if you put your hand out to adjust the throttle, you're likely to grab the spark plug, which was a bit anti. one of the problems with it. But the idea was that they were, now they got planes big enough, they used to take the dog teams out. You know, they could get a dog team on the sledge and gear into an otter. And the idea was to get, you know, to go over more to motors, certainly trying them. And now, of course, it's all Ski-Doos.
So on this first ever one, then, were you observing potential improvements? Were you making
recommendations? Yes, I had to do a field report on it. So I was trying to calculate fuel consumption, for instance, which inaccurate, as we weren't going any great distances. And there was this problem of these drive belts just melting and bits of canvas flying off. Luckily, I had enough spares to keep me go for the winter, so I ordered a whole box and boxes of them for next year. And they were fine. I think we just had a duff lot. The other problem, it was in soft snow, particularly if towing a sledge, it used to dig itself in. The Eliasson was even worse. So it was generally seeing how the thing performed, and it was very good at starting in cold weather, for instance, in pool start in those days. Generally, it worked very well, the Ski-Doo, and they were in due course sort of taken up by Bass. Because when the dogs went, it was all Ski-Doos. Health and safety didn't come into it, of course, didn't wear helmets or anything like that. a very scathing set of the Eliasson. It wasn't so much a field report as a back garden report, because it really didn't go very far from the base before it broke down.
So did you see any of the recommendations you made actually come to pass?
That I wouldn't know, because I was home and gone by then. And I don't think I recommended much. I described one thing we did for these reins for steering the ski. We welded loops onto the side of the ski-doo to take them so they didn't get tangled up. And that was a bit of a nasty. The mechanic, Wally Dawson, was using an electro-welding kit to weld these loops on. And he had a bit too much power, and he was burning holes in the body of the ski-doo and just sort of welding them over. When we finished, we realised we'd been burning holes in the petrol tank. So we sat down and had a cigarette and realised it wasn't the best place for that either. But we used to say that, the guardian angel looks after sort of fools, drunkards and fizz. Or any combination.
Tell me about the Plastic Palace, because I think you were partly involved in...
Yes, we were building it that year.
Because the Shackleton was a bit late, wasn't it, that year?
It was. We were, first of all, delayed. I remember we actually had a sort of telegram or phone call or whatever in those days, delaying our departure by a week. That may have been because bits hadn't arrived. And in those days, they were always having strikes at Southampton. And when we eventually got down there, everyone was sitting down. And the reason was that they were loading the plastic panels, and the idea was that you bolted loops onto these things, put strops through them and lifted on board. And these idle dockers hadn't apparently done up these loops properly. And one had come away and sort of hit their foreman. So they said, right, we want danger money. So that delayed us a bit more. Then we got down to Stanley, and Signy was reporting pack ice well to the north. They'd sent a party. They climbed up Coronation Island, up to sort of 3,000 feet or whatever, so they could see right up to the north. There's nothing but ice. So after waiting a bit, they said, right, that there were some government passengers for South Georgia, and Bass used to take them down to the little colony there, administrative colony. And they wanted volunteers to stay ashore so that these people could go on board. So with Pete Redfern and some others, we said, oh, we'll stay ashore. I was staying with Ian Strange and thoroughly enjoying Port Stanley life. And after, I realised how ridiculous I missed this opportunity to go to South Georgia. But of course, as events unfolded, it didn't matter. So that was big. We went down to the ice and couldn't get to Deception. We had a spare part for a plane which had got damaged. I think it was a bit of tailplane. And we rendezvoused with the Biscoe in the ice and managed to get this large lump of metal from one ship to the other, which was all good fun. It was absolutely marvellous being out in the pack ice. It's superb scenery and a marvellous experience. I went back to Stanley again. So we were eventually about a month late there. As we went back to Stanley, as we left Stanley, my shoes had developed holes. I said, well, I won't need them for 2 years. I threw them over the side of the ship. A week later, we're back in Stanley, dance. And so I bought brand new shoes. And they French polished the floor of the town hall. And with these absolutely brand new shoes, I had no traction whatsoever. And luckily, I was doing the Gay Gordons with quite a stoutly built girl, and she had her hands under my armpits holding me up while my feet were scrabbling. But eventually it got in, and yes, it was delayed. Then there was another delay because we laid the concrete piers and then found that no one had sent any of the bolts to bolt the metal RSJs to the foundations. They had to be made up at great speed in Port Stanley, and HMS Protector brought them down on a sort of special run almost. So it got later and later, and obviously wasn't going to be finished properly before the end of the summer, and Dick Stocks, who was in charge of building, stayed on for the winter to help out. The other tradesmen, like the plumber and the electrician, they had to go home. And so Dick was doing a lot of extra work. He and mechanic Wally, who could do electrical stuff, of course. And there's Joe, the carpenter. He was going to winter anyway.
What was the origin of the plastic parts?
It was made in Birmingham. And apparently the first use was for automatic telephone exchange. Now, they're ugly buildings. We used to say it looked like a double-decker bus that had run into a brick wall. It was sort of corrugated. And the other, you know, the old Fids who'd lived in the traditional black wooden huts, real heroic age stuff, really sort of, oh, I wouldn't like to live in that. And we pointed out it is extremely comfortable that we had electric heating and running water, well, fairly running water. And eventually one, I think a chap from Halley Bay, he admitted that, yes, you know, he changed his mind when we saw what a good bar we had. That was built by Joe Sutherland. And Joe, he had a theory that whatever you built on Fids, someone would say, no, we don't like that, we'll do it differently. And so he built this bar of huge great lumps of timber with 6-inch nails and 3-inch screws and interlocking pieces of timber. And years later, when I came down on the second trip to Bird Island, I met someone who'd been at Signy, and he said, yes, they'd decided to, they'd wanted the bar the other side of the room. And it took them days to get it apart. When they finally got it apart, there's a little pencil note, ha ha, I knew you'd try and move this, Joe Sutherland.
Was the plastic palace difficult to put together? Was it tricky?
I must admit, I sort of rather got out of a lot of it, partly because my colleagues very generously let me go and do skewer work, and also because I got toothache twice. Got, first of all, shipped up to South Georgia and then up to Stanley. So I missed a lot of the crucial stuff. But I missed, for instance, the erection of the steelwork, which, again, once they'd got these bolts, I think went up fairly easily. We, you know, had a long pole with a pulley on it and lots of blokes pulling rope, known as Fid Power, mm-hmm. and got all that up. And then it was a matter of putting these panels on, fiberglass panels, and the problem there was that they had holes pre-drilled, and when they were put on, the holes weren't meeting up, which meant drilling new holes, and because there's a sort of a flange like that, it was actually very difficult to get a drill in. So there was much cursing about the hole should have been drilled with a template, so there shouldn't have been a problem. So what had happened, I don't know. But it did make it a bit more difficult. The other problem was we had this mastic between the panels as jointing, and they sent sort of nice sort of warm weather mastic, which was solid. So we had this brazier with old packing crates and so on. We'd have to heat this stuff up over the fire and then whack it into place and screw the whole thing together. And when it was finished, it was found that the upper story overlapped the lower story. Again, the holes didn't fit. Mm-hmm. So Dick Stocks put a rope round it, and they put a Spanish windlass in, and it was Joe Sutherland and Tiny Norris were winding this handle, squeezing the whole thing together. And Joe said to Tiny, have you got hold of it? And Tiny said, yes. And Joe let go, and Tiny hadn't got hold of it. And, of course, his Spanish windlass spun round and whacked Joe on the head. But he's a solid citizen. He sported a little plaster for a few days. And that really was our only industrial accident, I think. Again, you know, it's the guardian angel. Health and safety hadn't been invented. Martin Holgate was taking a film, cinefilm, for the manufacturers. And Dick Stocks would rush up and say, no, you can't film that. The factory inspectors might see it because that's all there were in those days. I mean, the scaffolding would be an old, empty old drum balanced on a rock and someone perched on it. You used your common sense, I think, basically, because there was this nucleus of a building team, the craftsmen, and the rest of us joining in all the sort of donkey work, mixing concrete, knocking in nails, all the sort of easy stuff, general manpower, heaving stuff around, pulling ropes. university graduates who perhaps not terribly experienced as navvies.
Was there ever any tension about that? Because it was all hands to the pump, and some guys had actually gone down there as scientists or met men.
There was, and I gather you've been primed on this probably, which I missed and only heard it in retrospect, that Charlie Lefevre, the diving assistant, had fallen out with Dick Stocks. Dick had experienced builder. He was an older man, I guess in his 40s then, which to us, he was an old man and he was bald and everything. But he worked around the world as a steel erector and so on. He'd built the Deception Hangar previously, so he'd worked on FIDs. And the whole thing, I mean, he just glued the whole thing together. He knew how to do it. Charlie Lefevre, old FID, 2 polar medals. He'd been on the Royal Society party at Halley Bay as a radio op, and then at Stonington, and he'd hold the fort at Stonington when all the rest of the base had gone out on sledge trips, but was a bit of an abrasive character. I got on very well with him, but that was superficial, and Charlie felt that there ought to be more priority given to getting the marine lab sorted out, because the marine biologists were working in the old urinal at the end of the off-fire hut, which wasn't terribly satisfactory. And I gather, and Dick was, he could be a stroppy bloke. And one of them called the other out, to have a fight on the planet at dawn. I came back on the ship and we were told no one's to go ashore. I thought, what's going on here? And Johnny Green, as a logistics officer who was the senior man around, headquarters man, he went ashore. And later they came back with Charlie. And what had happened, the base leader had sort of reported his problems. He wasn't a particularly dominant man himself, I think, and called for help. And they said the only thing is, Charlie's got to go. Dick is essential. Can't, they need him to build the base. And Charlie went. Eventually ended up in Australia, I think, I heard, in the prison service. And alas, because we were late, the existing diesel mechanic, Alf Amphlett, another very experienced bloke, he'd been again at the Halley Bay base with Charlie Lefevre, former warrant officer in the Royal Engineers. He had been wintering the year before and he volunteered to stay on to help put the mechanics and electrics together with Wally. And he was so fed up with that, he resigned. He did, in fact, come down again the next year and went to Halley Bay, and he called in at Cygni. And he said, as soon as he'd resigned, he'd really regretted it. His principles should have been pushed back, because he was a marvellous man. He was the gash hand when I did my first cook duty, and I'd never cooked before, except at sort of Boy Scout camp, and there were 22 on the base, all the building team. There I was with 3 meals, 2 smokos and bread to bake, without a clue, and really, Alf carried me through that. I've always been grateful.
Were there any handicaps of the Plastic Palace? And I think I've heard other FIDs say that they were very, very noisy to be in.
Yes. I was a bit surprised that there was no lagging between the lounge and the sleeping quarters. And as we were rather a noisy, or a lot of us were a rather noisy lot, for the quiet people that must have been a penance. Also, there's nothing between the upper story and lower story. So if you're working downstairs, you could hear people trundling around.
Did that matter?
The working bit didn't matter so much. And as I was one of the noisy ones, the other didn't matter. Except when I was on... Yes, I used to have to sleep off Night Met, but I was at the sort of far end, and it didn't. That didn't impinge on me.
Tell me about the toothache, because this was still in your first summer, wasn't it?
Yes, I had a dine out on this. We hadn't been there long and I got a raging toothache. I've never had a toothache before. And we'd had dental checks not only with our home dentist, we all went up to the School of Dentistry, I think it's at London Hospital, one of the London hospitals, Marlin Road. And there I was, this toothache, and, you know, and paracetamol and rum, nothing affected it. And Shackleton was going past Sydney up to South Georgia and back, straight back. We had to pick, you know, he'd had to pick up some gear which had come down on the Kista Dan. And so I shipped aboard, and no one had told the captain. It came in just to drop one crate, so the hook went over the side, launch took it, went back out, and there was me on it. And the captain looked out of the bridge and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I've had permission, sir, honest, I'm going to have my teeth done." And no one had bothered to tell the ship that this was happening. But sort of not a problem. And we went up to South Georgia, and of course, as soon as the ship comes in, party starts, dentist joins in, Ian Cummings. And I sort of came up to, and I said, "Look, I've got this." Oh, so a filling had subsequently fallen out as well. The tooth had stopped aching, but another filling had fallen out. I said, "I'll come to have this looked at." He said, "I'll blow that," and threw it over his shoulder. And the next day I went to see him. And many years later, I gave a talk in St Andrews, where he had a practice, to the RSPB, and he was the chairman. And he started off by saying, "I've got an apology to make. This man is the only patient I've treated while drunk." That's me drunk, not the patient. In fact, he was a hangover, but he did say that every time he bent over to look inside my mouth, he came over all funny. But anyway, I was sent back to Sydney, and I got another toothache. And this time, well, I got on the Shackleton, we transferred to the Kista Dan, rode out an enormous storm, and went up to South Georgia. And, well, we picked up Ian Cumming, who was going home on leave, and went up to Stanley, and I went to see the dentist there who took x-rays. And I think it was 13 teeth needed attention, one extraction, one root filling. And what had happened, he was most bitter about the National Health Service. I had decay forming under my fillings, so he had to ream them out and replace them. And so he spun this out over the course of several weeks, so it wasn't too agonising, which meant I couldn't get out and about in the Falklands. But then eventually ship came back, and we went down to Port Lacroix to rendezvous with the Biscoe, which had been stuck in the ice for weeks, up to Deception and back to Sydney. I thought, I never used to have to travel that far to see the dentist. But I had missed rather a lot, but I did get to see South Georgia. One of the trips, second trip, we were looking for fuel. So we went round all the old whaling stations looking for fuel for Sydney. Was, I think, one of the things was no one had realised we had these lovely new huge great Rolls-Dale diesel generators which needed an awful lot of fuel. And got some from South Georgia, which was awful stuff. It just clogged the filters. And we got more in Stanley on my second trip. There's only about six of us on board, and we had to fill a couple of hundred oil drums from the ship, sort of in a petrol pump style, fill them up, tip them over, run them up the jetty, stand them upright. Then when we filled them all, tip them over, run them back down, tip them upright on board. And we did those in that sort of thing in those days. And on one occasion, the place was slippery with diesel, and I pulled one of these drums over. I just got on the point of balance, and I slipped under it. And luckily, there was a large man standing there who held on to it long enough for me to get out. Otherwise, I don't think I'd be here now. Again, the guardian angel. So that was the teeth. And also, it enabled me to evacuate the base cat.
Ginge.
I dine out on the story of Ginge, who was a lovely cat if you're a cat lover. Very friendly pussycat. Talkative. Very touch of the Orientals, like our cats. They meow a lot. And people didn't know about cats, and he'd come in and meow, and they'd go, "Oh, you're hungry," or "You're thirsty," and they'd get food out and so on. Just saying hello. But he used to get out at night and kill these prions and petrels which were nesting around the back of the base. And Martin Holgate said, you know, we can't have this on a biological station. That's why our dogs had been taken away, yeah. So we didn't have to kill seals for them.
So there was a price on the cat's head, wasn't there?
There was, and, you know, it was Mrs. Chippy reinvented. Martin was going to take her away and shoot poor old Ginge, and of course, not very popular. But luckily for Ginge, I got this toothache, and I got permission from actually Sir Vivian Fuchs to take the cat with me, and... we found a couple in Stanley, a radio operator and his wife, who were down on contract, who said, yes, they'd take on Ginge. So I made him a nice box with his blanket and his bowl and got on the Kista Dan, and we rode out this storm. And I was based in the forecastle, so we're going up over these waves and into free fall. And all our luggage was in a corridor outside, which was sliding up and down. And I like to say, it's totally inaccurate, that you know what the Doppler effect is. Well, it was like that all night as Ginge was going up and down. Meow! Meow! And the poor... I mean, every time I sat up, you know, I felt sick, so I couldn't help him. But luckily, the ship's cook was a cat lover, so Ginge went to the after end of the ship and was had a much pleasanter trip than I did. And the last I heard, that they'd... this couple had actually taken him back to England. And it used to be funny watching him because he used to stalk the sheathbills, your little white birds that run around. And you see this ginger cat stalking a white bird over snow. And you know how a cat's tail waggles when it's hunting? Well, the sheathbills used to line up behind it, pecking at it. It was not very elegant for a predator. So, yes, and after that, of course, no... No cats allowed.
And the tooth?
Tooth, they survived. I had a lot of trouble with them since, but when I came back, you know, they survived the rest of the time.
Let's take a pause.
Yes.